Okay, everybody. So this is exciting to have us together, to have a call and to think about storytelling in organization. And Molly Catron is on the phone with us, and she's going to share a little bit about her background right now. So Molly, why don't you just jump in there?
I was wondering if it'd be possible just a quick intro of who all's out there.
Sure.
Scott.
Could everybody introduce themselves just very, very quickly?
Sure. Great. Greetings. This is Tom Sparrow facilitating our call today. We have a nice group of people who are joining the call. And right now what we're going to do is we're just going to one by one say who we are and just maybe a little bit where we're from and our interest in storytelling and organization, but just kind of brief. So I'm the new chair of storytelling and organization. I'm in Cincinnati, and I work with all kinds of different organizations, and I kind of specialize in the use of metaphor. Great, so that's enough about me. Somebody else just jump in there.
Hi, this is Genevieve Waller. I just signed on. I just wanted to let you know I'm in.
Great. Well, welcome, Genevieve. We are just saying a little bit about who we are, where we're from, and just a sentence or two about our interest in storytelling and organization. Why don't you just take it since you just joined?
Oh, okay. Thank you. And I apologize for kind of interrupting. So I'm in Chicago. And my background, I actually have come into storytelling from journalism, which actually has been kind of a good fit for me. And I've been doing a lot of storytelling in educational settings, both with students and teachers, trying to get them to incorporate more storytelling into their classrooms. And I like to actually widen my scope, and so I'm very new at storytelling in organizations. But the people that I've talked to kind of very informally surveying are saying, wow, what a great idea, that's so cool, and so I think there's a lot of opportunity to explore and grow that area of what
yeah.
I do.
Great, thank you. And somebody else just jump in there.
Yeah, it's Jules.
Hi, this is Tricia Griffin-Cardi. I'm from the greater Boston area in Massachusetts, and I use storytelling in two ways, with individuals so they can advance their careers by building their reputation using stories, and also in businesses for people thinking around leadership or team building, how to use stories to accomplish those goals.
Thanks.
And what was your first name?
Oh, Tricia. Tricia.
Tricia. Okay.
And Julianne, why don't you?
Oh, yeah, I think I dovetail nicely between my two predecessors there. I discovered that I was using story, or my staff informed me that it was a talent. I was using it quite a bit with management as well as in interviewing, because I used to always say, like, bring your story to life and use it as a teaching moment. And I've moved to really concentrate and find ways I can start to use it much more in my work. So I've been giving workshops, learning as I'm going, and facilitating career transition workshops, as well as using it as a coaching tool. And I'm also pitching. I've taught some classes jumping into either graduate students or undergraduate students about using it in their work. So I'm eager to learn more and do more and bring it forward, especially with all the changes we have in education happening right now. I think storytelling still has a place, even though the curriculum is changing quite a bit in the schools.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Craig Hackenboo Harrison. I'm in Berkeley, California. And I use storytelling as a professional speaker and trainer. I'm also active in some storytelling organizations and creating and sustaining some hybrids that kind of go between different organizations like NSN and NSA, the National Speakers Association, Toastmasters, and storytelling associations here in California and elsewhere. And I've been paying dues for SIO for a while and never had the time or to sync up, and I'm just excited to finally partake of my membership and contribute as well. Thank you.
Great.
Hello, this is Laverne Schuler. I'm from Columbia, South Carolina. I'm also involved in Toastmasters. I'm active in our South Carolina Storytelling Network. I don't have any real experience in terms of storytelling in organizations, but my interest is in storytelling as it relates to knowledge management.
Great. I'll jump. I'm Michael Scott. I'm from Baltimore. Equity Matters is our organization. And we're a little different. We don't so much tell stories as try to facilitate others telling their stories. And our primary focus is promoting equity in all policy, home, federal, state, local, governmental, and corporate as well. And we really think that having voice to shift policy is critical. And so we try to help, not only help community project their stories into policy change opportunities through the policy fulcrums we help set, but we also try to quantify the qualitative stories that they're told. We think that qualitative data is just quantitative data that hasn't been counted yet. So we rely on the quality of the stories to move people, but we also think that once we understand where stories congregate, that tells the story as well. And so we're experimenting with how to use storytelling to shift policy directly from the voice of communities that are often unheard from.
Great. Thanks, Michael.
Well, I guess I didn't hear anybody. So I'm Robin. I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I've done medical, marketing, association, universities, keynotes. And my interest is in nonprofits and marketing, business communication. But I have a full-time job as an engineer, so I don't do this all the time. Well, that's me.
Yeah, thanks, Robin.
Hi, this is Mark Steinman. Good morning, good afternoon, depending on what part of the country you're calling from. I am the assistant chair for the group, and I'm a human resource chief administrative officer, executive in the financial services and other areas. And my interest really came to be as I was developing my leadership skills, and still am. I found story to be one of the most effective ways to increase engagement and trust amongst employees, and especially between the executive team and the rest of the organization. And so storytelling in organizations is a perfect fit.
Great.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
This is Ann Scroggy. I'm from Gainesville, Florida, and I work with a group that we have established, and what we do is called Empower Speakers. And we do training and go into corporations and help them adjust, modify, expand their public speaking abilities. And the first thing we say is get rid of the PowerPoint.
Yes.
And tell me a story.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Ann.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else out there? Okay. Well, then, Molly, we'll turn it back over to you.
Yeah, Ann Scroggy and I are great buddies. I didn't know you were out there, Ann. we've worked a lot together. Okay, I don't want to bore you with my background. If you've been out on my website, the one that I'm building by myself, so I have total control over it. If I ever get it built, I have a pretty lengthy description out there. But I started at Eastman Chemical Company, which was a subdivision then of Eastman Kodak, as a chemist, and then was pulled off to do empowerment training. This was early 80s, 81. And I think I was pulled off because the operations people, the people on the production floor, liked me, and I had a personality, which was kind of unusual in that organization. So I made them laugh, and I told them stories. And so I suppose that was where the story started, because I came from a family of storytellers, and I intuitively used it in training. But then I was made a manager of a group, a big analytical laboratory with 51 direct reports, and I was told to empower them. And it was only about a week or two that I had been there that they told me what to do with that empowerment. I realized not only did they not want to be empowered, my managers really didn't want to empower them, and I was caught in the middle of that. But it did fascinate me, this resistance to change and all of that. And the company had a lot of money then, so they sent me wherever I wanted to go for any sort of training. And where I ended up getting most of my training and most of the reading I did, workshops I did, was with MIT. So I'm strongly influenced by their organizational change model. Following people like Peter Senge and Chris Argus and Art Kleiner and Barry Oshry, and I was a certified Covey instructor because we found out that if we were going to shift from a rule-based organization to a principle-based organization, we need to build character. We still haven't quite got there on that, I don't think. So I was certified as a Covey instructor. We did Myers-Briggs, the whole nine yards. After I finished that management position, or after that, it wore me completely out, being caught in the middle of that, the manager who didn't want to empower them and the group who didn't want to be empowered. My management decided they would form this learning organization group, and that group would be responsible for corporate change. And so that resulted in a really big career change for me. I never did go back to the bench as a chemist, but I continued to study organizational change. And they would bring to us, I think, where we came to look at story differently. I just took it for granted and didn't think about it, was they would bring to our group things like the upper management team, the executive team would say, team management isn't working. Go out there and find out why. Or they'd say, the safety program's not getting us where we want to go. Go out there and find out why. And so we would march out there with a list of questions to ask the operations folks and to get a response. And we would get back and analyze these questions, and that's not where the information would be. We would find ourselves saying, remember the story the operator told about the night shift, or remember the one the engineer told about trying to put in that new piece of equipment? And we found that within the story was the tacit knowledge and the information that we really wanted. So that began our conscious look at problem solving, analyzing, looking at, listening for stories. And so I was also strong. Are you guys familiar with the work of Art Kleiner, Learning Histories?
No, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you should know who Art Kleiner is. In fact, at one time when we very first started the SIO SIG, we were wooing Art Kleiner to join. But Art Kleiner did a body of work around learning histories. And what he would do is go out and collect the stories of everybody involved with a given project and after the project was completed. He would collect stories around projects that worked out really well and also around projects that flopped. And he would get the perspective of everyone involved in the chain that was to make that happen. And he recorded all these stories, and those stories were what people would learn from. It was a great body of work, and I was influenced by his work quite a bit. And so we were doing a lot of learning histories at the time. And what we noticed was, of course, like anything, you learn more from mistakes most of the time than you do successes. But in the organization, of course, nobody wants to talk, especially management, about a failure. Or in, wait a minute, let me back up. In the chemical industry, okay, maybe out there in other organizations, that's not a problem. But usually the managers did not want to bring up anything that was a failure. So we were never able to do anything except look at the glowing success story. We always wanted to look at the failures. And with that thought in mind, this learning organization, we started looking at stories just for our own edification that were occurring at the water cooler. The stories that the folks were talking about, the scuttlebutt that was going around. You know, now these stories could have been very true, very accurate, or they could have been a bunch of hooey, but whichever they were, those stories were powerful. they worked, no matter whether they were absolutely true or not. They shaped and worked on the cultures. So that began my work looking at the difficult stories, not at just the pretty stories. Most of the organizations I've worked with, even after I retired, only wanted to look at the pretty stories. And they were just not ready. Their readiness level wasn't there. Well, what we found, the learning organization, what we learned is Peter Senge, I quote him like a guru. He was a guru to me. He said that the shallowest change occurs on the process level. If you want to change deeper, you need to look at structures and strategies that you've designed to support those processes. And if you want to go even deeper and have transformational change, you need to change your beliefs, values, and assumptions. And I have never seen anything play out more true in the chemical industry than those principles that he laid out. And let me give you an example of how that worked, not to be too simplistic. If I am, tell me to go away. But, for example, if a company in our particular area, let's say they wanted to, the hot thing early in the 80s was to bring in team management. And so what they did was set up everything to operate the processes on a team format. So that was the process, was to have decisions made by a team. The structure and the strategy was based on team management, and so everything was organized in these pods and teams around things. And that appeared to be okay. I mean, that was the right change, and that far down the thinking process. But then they never looked at the beliefs, values, and assumptions. So what would happen is they'd pull a team together, and in the right structure, intent on making a decision, but they had a first-line supervisor or a department head who really didn't think he had anything to learn from the operation team. So that was part of his beliefs. His assumptions were that they had nothing that he could learn. In our organization, if you didn't go to Clemson or Alabama and have an engineering degree, you probably didn't have anything to offer. And so he would bring them into the room just so they could come up with his decision.
Uh-huh.
So needless to say, it didn't take too long before the operations people realized that and said, well, you know, this team management is a bunch of hooey, and they wouldn't participate. So that's an example of how you can change the process. You can even change the structure, but if you have the underlying beliefs, values, and assumptions there, things won't change. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now,
yes.
Of course, people don't want to look at those things and usually don't look at them until they're faced with some sort of terrible thing that happens with them, and they're forced to look at their belief systems and check their assumptions. Some people never do. But we found that if we could have these folks look at a difficult story, while they were discussing that story, if it did not occur to them, you know, if we took a difficult story that occurred in an organization, right in that organization, we would produce every organizational defense routine. Chris Argist is another word. If you don't know his work, you should, because organizations stay the way they are because there are these organizational defense routines that people put up to make them stay that way. So if you brought in a difficult story, like the one I'm going to tell you today about the rubber glove war, into an organization where it actually occurred, everyone would get defensive, and especially the managers, so it just would not work. But if you took a difficult story from another organization that was similar, and you had, as a consultant, had gotten a sniff of the fact that they had some of the same problems, that you had witnessed with the story, then you brought it into that organization, and they thought about that story together, or they dialogued, or they did critical thinking exercise, or just listened to it and talked about it. You didn't have to have a formal process. You, as a consultant, and they, if they would be willing to look at it, could get a hint at the hidden beliefs, values, and assumptions.
Yeah.
And when I had actually participated in that, I was shocked at catching myself in radically in different assumptions that I had no idea I was making by the way I responded to a given story. So that began this body of work that I still do a lot of, which is using difficult stories to stimulate a meaningful dialogue or critical thinking. Now, does any of that make sense? Any questions up to this point about what I've said, what I left out?
No, it's terrific.
Yeah. I'm a crazy woman lately because, see, I've made a radical shift to the performance world, and this is October. So I've been out in every haunted hollow telling scary stories or harvest stories or October's just absolutely crazy for performance work. So in a minute, if I go off track and start telling you a spooky Appalachian story, pull me back in. You know,
Molly,
it's,
I think
it where
might be
it's where I've been. Although you might like them, you know.
Molly,
so,
I was muted, but you mentioned Art Kleiner, and could you repeat the name of the second man whose work?
Chris Argus. Tom, did you get to send those things out to him? I sent it so late. I sent you a list of references that I'm going to be referring to quite a few people.
So it's on the last page. Got it. Thank you.
Right. Chris Argus. His work is his early work is very difficult to read. His later work, it got more readable, but is a genius on cultural dynamics. He's amazing. I was so influenced by both Chris Argus and Peter Senge and Barry Oshry. Those folks are names that form the basis. You know, if you're going to go, the dilemma of using story, I did a talk at one of the conferences on this, is if you're going to do stories, you have to wear both hats. You have to understand organizational dynamics. And you have to be a good storyteller. And what happens is good storytellers decide to go into organizations, have no background of organizational dynamics, and they really screw up the works. Or an OD consultant can go in there and not realize what makes a good, powerful story and screw up the works.
Yep.
So I do a lot of training of trying to marry those two. So if you're going to go in there, you know, and usually you got to be good at both of those things. And so I was fortunate enough, blind hauled finding an acorn, because to have the opportunity to go and study like I did in the early part of my career, and the fact that I think it was wonderful that I studied with the folks at MIT. Now, if you talk to somebody from Harvard, they may say something different, but don't believe them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Don't believe them.
I'm having trouble,
Molly,
understanding the story of the call. What's the structure of, because I feel like there's so much wisdom, but I'm missing it because I don't know where I am in the story of this call.
Okay, here I'm going to put you, I'm sorry if I've done that. I'm sorry. I am going to give you an example of one of these difficult stories. And Tom, if he hadn't sent you out these things
sent
you.
Yes, Molly, Tom here. And yes, I did send out those two documents, but they didn't go out until the last hour here.
Yeah, it was real late. I have a little process. This is not the end-all, be-all process. I borrowed it, and I gave a reference to who I borrowed it from. Any process will work that I use to process these difficult stories. And an example of an evaluation, just because I thought that would be interesting to you.
And Molly, let me just give a time note because I want to honor what I put out on the email.
Okay.
So we're approaching a half hour here, and I said that the call would last between a half hour and 45 minutes. So we can certainly, anybody who's able to stay longer can, but I think we should jump into the story, and then we can talk about application and open it up to questions.
Excellent.
That's great. I'll talk forever if you give me a chance, so you've got to keep me under control. Okay, here was the situation. And now I'm going to tell it because it happened to me, but if I was telling this in another organization, I'd make it about another organization, okay? But the company was interested in safety because OSHA recordable accidents were up. This was a chemical company, and of course they're worried about that. In fact, accidents in general were higher than they wanted it to be. So they had instituted this new behavior. There's always somebody coming out with a new safety behavior. This one, a new safety program. This one focused on operators' behaviors. This was supposed to be the answer. And they thought in a high-risk chemical company, they could reduce the accidents to nothing, to at zero accidents, if they focused on operators' behavior. So they started pulling the folks, the operations people, the people on the floor, who were operating the equipment, into these meetings to analyze their behavior. And the operators hated it because they felt like they were really being scrutinized right down to the nth degree, and they felt like there were more things that contributed to accidents than just their behavior, like old equipment or some situation, and maybe just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the operators were brought into these safety, after an accident occurred, into these safety reviews, and it was kind of intimidating. They were brought in, there would be two managers and one person at a time, and they were grilled about their behavior, every action they did. And the operators described it like a Nuremberg trial. You know, the only thing that was missing was the hot light on your head. You know? And so they absolutely hated it. And so this particular time, I was working with this group. I was working in this one division to look at what was going on with their safety behavior. And there was this piece of equipment. And when I was meeting with them, the operators kept saying, this piece of equipment is an accident getting ready to happen. There was a long pipes that run from one piece of operations equipment to another, and it had a valve on it with a sight glass, and that valve, when it was actually operating, was bucking and jumping. It was moving, and that meant to us as chemists and engineers that there was a possible reaction happening in the pipe. And so they reported this as part of the normal safety review. They said, hey, you need to look at this because it's bucking and jumping. And the manager that was on that particular shift, first line and second line, said, look, the engineers designed that piece of equipment. They know what they're doing. It's working over in this other production building. You know, you're just trying to find something to gripe about. So they wouldn't listen to the operators. Well, it was on one graveyard shift, and this big fella, young guy, who was an apprentice operator, was working on the piece of equipment. He was over 6'2". He must have weighed 200 pounds. He'd been a big football player, and he had a big, wide neck, and that was going to be to his advantage later on in the evening. Everybody loved the kid, and he was a real conscientious worker. And he was out there working on that piece of equipment, and it exploded. And a piece of the equipment flew and struck him in the neck, right near his jugular vein. If not, I guess it severed veins close to the jugular vein, but I don't know that it got his jugular vein. But he was, blood just went everywhere. And these two operators came over really quickly and put their hands on it to make a compression to hold it so that he wouldn't bleed out right then until safety could come. And so safety, the emergency people came, and they were able to get him to the hospital. And he survived because these operators had taken such quick action. Well, after when they had the safety review, which was a long, long process, they grilled that kid unmercifully until they couldn't find anything that he had actually done that was wrong. But they grilled him quite a bit, even though he was in the hospital. And then the only thing that they could do, or the only thing that came out of it that they knew of, was the next morning when the two guys came in who saved his life, and medical had said if they had not taken their actions, that he would have died. The two fellows who came in who had saved his life were written up for not putting on rubber gloves before grabbing his neck. and that was because he would be they were exposed to bodily fluids, and they were written up, and that is what started the rug of love war. You can imagine what happened to the safety program after that.
And this is a true story, right?
This is a true story. Now, where I might use that is if they're brave enough, is a group of managers and operators together, and they can talk about what happened, why it happened, what systems were involved, what beliefs, values, and assumptions were made. I gave you guys the process. It's highly controlled. Sometimes I use it with just managers because they can talk about what went on in this, you know, or just operations people. And the idea here is this is directed toward the chemical industry, but there are other difficult stories you can use. In fact, people have been bugging me to put out a book of difficult stories, but you can find them anywhere. They're dilemma stories. And I gave you an example of one that's from the chemical industry. And if you looked at yourself as you heard that story, you could probably go through the process, like the section where I mentioned examining your own map, your own, I use the term map a lot because people would gag at the word paradigm. So I use the word map. But if you looked at exploring your own map, you could probably answer those questions about where you felt uncomfortable in the story, where you had some sort of a physical reaction. Usually when you have a visceral reaction or something, or some thought pops in your mind, that's where you're encountering a belief, value, or an assumption.
Can I ask a question here? This is Genevieve from Chicago.
I'd love for you too, Genevieve.
That's a very powerful story. But I'm wondering when you're in an organization and using that as an example, do you tell it out then as to what kind of the war actually looked like as it came into the company, and if it resolved itself, or how it resolved itself, or how people, again, if you're in a company, would work to resolve a situation that is that tense and kind of even dangerous to the whole work environment.
Yeah, see, that's what I want them to do.
Okay.
So the story is meant to put them in a position to think about their thinking, you know, to try to how would they resolve it? What happened? What was happening underneath it? You know, like if it's a manager's group, they're going to get real defensive about what went on with management. You know, they're sure that someone was maybe in the management chain was written up. I don't know, as a matter of fact. I was involved with the team and was not allowed to go in with any of it. I never knew if anyone was written up, but I don't have to mention that to them. Very most likely, some manager's lost his head over that. I didn't see anybody get fired, but he probably got chewed pretty badly. But see, the operators didn't see any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they need to, that. So they go through and analyze the roles that take. That's what I want them to do with the story. I don't tell them anything. I'm plowing the ground for them to think about their thinking.
Oh, great, thank you.
Does that make
sense? It makes sense, yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
And Molly, Tom, a quick question here too.
Mm-hmm.
So to decide to tell this story, would that be someone, an organization hires you, and part of why they've hired you is they say something like, you know, we seem to have a disconnect between management and frontline workers right now, and
mm-hmm.
we're looking to build dialogue and teamwork between the two entities. Is that the kind of situation you would use it in?
Yes. I assess right off the readiness level of any group I'm working with, whether or not they're ready for transformational change. And I would have a discussion with them about the whole idea of using a difficult story or to for critical thinking. It's not always one from a chemical industry. It could be anything. In fact, I'm doing a workshop with kids on critical thinking, third graders, using animal tails and getting them to look at the dilemma to figure out who's the hero, who's the villain. And what I'm trying to get them to do is to think about their thinking and why they think or feel a particular way. But I look at the readiness level of the group. That's why I don't work in the chemical industry anymore, as a matter of fact, because the readiness level is kind of low there because they're in survival mode. As long as you are trying to survive, you're focused on the bottom line, you're not wanting to do transformational change. You're just holding on, you know. And so many times it's a difficult thing to use a story like that in an organization. You have to know that they're ready for change. The last time I used it in a manufacturing process, it was a new startup plant, and they were training their first line supervisors and some of their next level, and we used dilemma stories like this so they could think together and build a meaningful dialogue. But now you have to be you have to know the group, and you have to know that the readiness level is there, and it has to be agreed upon that they want to go there.
Great. What other questions do we have out there?
Well, usually I go in the opposite direction. So the story I tell, which I won't go into, is a positive story, and I use it to make people think about what would it be like in their organization if they treated people as well as the story I just told. And I don't know if that would sell. I don't know how – I mean, I don't sell these things all the time, but I have done it.
Yeah, that's what I have called, and Madeline Blair, who used to be a member of that SOC, we call those future stories. And I use those quite a bit, too. Future stories folks are usually ready to move on, and there's not as many cultural barriers. These are for organizations where there's a lot of cultural barriers. Another thing that Peter Senge said is that what happens with organizations as they start this, they've got where they are now and where they want to go, they have to create this creative tension to get them from point A to point B. And what they do that's wrong is they don't own up to what reality's like, and they start at some level up that curve where they think they should be, and they don't go back to what reality is. And most of the time what I was doing was working with organizations that were having trouble seeing what was really happening. And so when you only use the positive stories, that plays into that dynamic of them in la-la land. But future stories are extremely powerful. I do more of that work probably now than I do, or as much as I do these dialogue stories. I think it's very powerful.
So
they can envision, like I had an operator one time said, hey, I want to go where you want to go. I mean, I think I do, because it's a wonderful thing, this vision you're talking about. He said, but I'm down in a barrel, and I'm just jumping up every once in a while, and I get a little hint of it, you know, just get a peek at it. So the future story allows them to not only understand the vision, but see where they fit into it. So it's so powerful, those kind of stories.
So this is Jules here. With the question that came to mind then, and the expression that came to mind when you said that, is after saying, okay, here's the vision stories, and then here's the difficult stories, and then, as Pima Shomer would say, like, start from where you are. How do you work with your people then to connect the dots? Is there a particular exercise or methodology? It sounds like you're using a lot of action learning, too, when you're working.
Yeah, I suppose whatever you're asking the question, if I understand it, if they're at this imagine position and you need them to see where now is, where they are in reality, is that what
Correct.
You're asking me?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? Anything and everything. But anything you can do to try to get them to see reality, because if you're an internal consultant, it can be a career-ending move. If you're an external consultant, it can be a career-ending move, you know. So what you need to do, if you've identified that they're in that imaginary position, you need to build high level of trust with them. This is my experience. High level of trust with them, and you need to keep enough pressure on them by using various things, these difficult stories or anything that you can that allows them to see that they're not where they are. That's why we taught Stephen Covey's 7 Habits was to help them analyze to see where they are. You notice I sent you the leadership disabilities.
That's
you know,
great.
That Peter Senge identified. Most of the time, what I'm seeing is one or more or all of those learning disabilities. So it depends on which disability seems to be the biggest that I'm pushing on at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For example, I love this little story. If I'm often with executive teams, and I'm sent in because everybody thinks they're the problem, but they don't think they're the problem.
Okay.
And so I have to gently figure out how to help them identify. They have to see it for themselves that they are the problem. So I don't want to get fired, you know, and I don't want to hurt their self-esteem, although that, you know, that's pretty easy to do at times. So I love to tell this story. When I first go in there, there was this guy who was the head of an insurance company, and he went out with his coworkers, the guys who worked for him, on the golf course to play golf, and he was teeing off, and he's a pretty good golfer, and everybody's watching him tee off and everything, and so he gets all set, and he swings at the ball, and he totally misses the ball, and everyone kind of gasps, and then he says, "Tough course." Now, if I'm in with an executive team and they laugh, then I can say, that's what we're here to talk about. You know? If they don't laugh, then I'm backing up and punting. You know, I've got a really big problem. Isn't that true of all of us, though? You know, we're all in this imaginary place, and how often we have to step back and look at where we really are, it's painful. And so,
can I ask you a question about that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's like a mini test that you do, yeah? So what's the role of, are you familiar with framing, George Lakoff and all that? Like, so what's the role of testing who, or knowing who's in the room? So if it's blue collar, white collar, if it's poor folks, rich folks, racial, where they, you know, what their frames are depending on what part of the country you're in. How do you know whether people are even hearing you based on where they're coming from? What is your approach to methodology in terms of figuring that out so that you can pull the right story to be heard?
I started to say when you said that, at this point, after being doing it for, close to 30 years now, it's my gut. But I do a lot of, if I pulled into a new company, just recently I was pulled into to do some work for the government. And, of course, now that work is dried up. But I was pulled in, and it was into an area where I was going to work with some folks that I have never, ever worked with those people in that profession, in that part of the country. And I do a lot of questioning, a lot of talking ahead of time to try to identify. But sometimes it's only until I get in with the group. That's why I have stories, pocket stories. These stories I keep in my pocket are things that I do. Only until I get in with the group can I sense what is going on. I have more experience, needless to say, with the chemical industry with operations folks in general, with people, engineers and chemists and that kind of thing. So if you pull me in to work with a bunch of bankers, I'm scrambling to try to understand the lingo, the culture and all that. So, but often I'm not called there because they're going to call me into manufacturing settings more often. Did that answer that at all?
Yeah, I think so.
But and we're at our 45 minutes now, So I know there are probably some people out there who budgeted their time and need to go. Molly, if people have questions, if they wanted to email you, would that be all right?
That's great, yeah. I love it, or a phone call. We'd have to sit some time. Like I said, this is October. But I'd be happy to talk on the phone, whatever I can do. I love to think together. I do not have all the answers. I can share what I tell people that besides going to the classes at MIT and reading everything in the world, I did scratch and sniff learning. If I did something and it smelled good afterwards, I'd do it again. If it didn't, I'd forget it. And I don't have all the answers, and it has refocused quite a bit. So you guys are probably up on the there's probably newer stuff out there that I don't even know about because I have consciously shifted to talking to people about, trying to teach people to do what I did and to learn from what I did and the performance work, because mainly organizational change work it wears you out. And I think the reason is that you are plowing the ground for change, but you don't have any control over it. You just need to set up the situation so that people can change themselves. And after a while, you want to do something where you get a product, where you have control over it. And it wore me out. And so you guys probably are more up to date on some of the things than I am now.
Well, I know we have Molly, Tom back here. We have quite a diverse group of people who are currently in the SIO. And so some people are just starting out and some people are quite experienced and some people are experienced in other ways, but they're coming in and finding that organizational work is interesting for them and they're exploring it. And we'll continue to explore this. We'll do another call next month. I think we are probably going to do the next month's call on a Sunday evening, which was the other doodle poll favorite of people's. And I've gotten two or three emails from other people who are disappointed that they wouldn't be able to be on this call, but that other timing works better for them. And I think we'll probably go back and forth. So we'll do some during the week and then some on Sundays. And I'll try to keep people in the loop there.
And Tom, this is Jules again. The fact that you're recording it is a big help because we all, I'm sure, would love to be on every call, but the fact we now have a resource is going to be quite helpful. And
yeah.
It will help in our work and our thought process too. It was a great thing today. I mean, perfect. Presentation and timing, just exactly what I needed, the exact week I needed it. So thank you guys.
I tell you, this organization is powerful because if we can all think together, it's amazing what you can come up with. When the organization first started, it was just the most stimulating environment because we weren't worried about who got the credit or who did what. We were just eager to learn, and so anything we would synergize in amazing ways. And so you guys have such a wonderful opportunity to do that with this organization.
Yeah, it is exciting, and for those of us who are thinking of the conference this summer, that hopefully will be an exciting time where we can gather together and talk, and we'll have a pre-conference session. If anybody has any comments or questions, feel free to give myself or Mark a call or an email, and we'll continue on. But I think we should finish up for today, and we'll continue next month. And as I say, email is a good way to get in touch with any questions or comments we have.
And thank you, everybody, for your participation, because it works when everybody's together here participating. That's great.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you all.
Thanks, Molly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Molly. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Okay,
thanks for sharing.
And I hope the guy lives happily ever after.
Thanks for sharing.
Bye.
Bye now.